Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to The Aware Show. It's great to be with you today, and it's truly a joy. It's truly a joy to be here and have you join me for this conversation that inspires our positive growth and change and moves us forward in our humanity, basically, what we have always done with The Aware Show. And we talk about topics that make a difference in our lives and the lives of others. This main topic we're talking about today is food. Now, it's not just the food and the food that we eat. It's our relationship with that food. Have you ever had an issue around weight loss, weight gain? Have you found that it takes up so much of your mental bandwidth? The next diet, the ways, the food that you should eat, the foods that you should avoid, the exercise, all of that. There's so much information out there that it gets confusing unless you really get to the layers underneath it. Joining me is Eliza Kingsford. She's a licensed psychotherapist with an intense passion for helping people heal their relationship with food. Her new book is called Brain-Powered Weight Loss. And the great thing about it, it has a 11-step first-of-its-kind program that helps you with mind-altering and behavior-changing exercises and techniques, rather than going after the right diet and the food and the exercise and so forth. It's got to happen between your ears first, and me too, so I'm excited to learn. Welcome, Eliza. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. So weight loss, has this been an issue for you or a struggle for you in the past?
You know, I think in its typical form, mm-hmm. honestly, no. However, body image struggles, being preoccupied with my weight, mm-hmm. being preoccupied with food choices, you know, what to eat, what exercise to do, how to be healthy, that has definitely been something that's been a part of my life for a very long time. I was an athlete in high school, and I was exposed to, you know, body image issues and, mm-hmm. and the struggles around that, and became really fascinated with our relationship to food and the body and how they were all intertwined. I have not been traditionally overweight in a sense, but I would say that that hasn't been terribly different from where my cognitive space has been at times.
Well, it's definitely a nationwide epidemic where people are not only realizing that food has a lot to do with your physical shape, but also emotional, and that mm-hmm. the gut biome has everything to do with mood and behavior. And it's linked a lot now, but you're actually linking it to the brain.
So, yeah, absolutely.
What does that word diet do to our brain?
Oh, man. I mean, you say the word diet, and I think automatically we are conditioned, and it triggers us to think about restriction, right?
Mm-hmm. Lack.
Restriction, mm-hmm. lack. What do I take out? You know, what am I in a lack of? What can't I have? You know, all of those things start running through the mind without even intentionally thinking about it. And in reality, we all have a diet, right? We all have a mm-hmm. collection of foods that we eat on a daily basis, which is our diet, right? But we use that term, or that term, I should say, has been used now so mainstream that it automatically triggers those feelings of lack and restriction.
Right. And it also is, let's talk a little bit about emotional eating. In my case, I eat sometimes when I need to stay awake, or if mm-hmm. I am doing mundane, like office work stuff, I will have something to munch on just to keep my brain fed. It's an emotional relationship with food. I could probably still do the same amount of work if I don't eat crunchy, salty things. But how much of what we do is emotional eating?
Yeah, I mean, the big ones, a lot, I would say. The big ones, habit, boredom, stress, right? And what you're talking about sounds likely a lot like habit. Mm-hmm. You probably started at one point where you had some food when you got really tired, and then it became almost like a Pavlovian response. So most people will recognize that famous, you know, scientific study where the dog was conditioned to salivate at the sound of a bell, even when there was no food, right? And so for you, what you just described in three sentences, so I'm making this all up, when you're working late at night, that has conditioned your brain to salivate like the dog or say, oh, I need food, you know, in order to keep me awake. Whether or not you actually do or not is another story. But when we do things in a repetitive way over and over again, it conditions our brain to get triggered for those things without really even intentionally thinking about it. Habit just being one of them, boredom being another, stress being another. And those are just three of the big ones. There's a whole number of reasons why people will quote-unquote emotionally eat. And I think a lot of people think emotional eating is automatically negative, right? They sort of, you get that picture in your mind of being knee-deep in a bucket of ice cream because you've broken up with your boyfriend kind of thing. It's not always like that. In fact, for a lot of people, it's like we just talked about, that habituation, repetition. You know, stress can certainly cause it, stress in a good or bad way, right? You just learn you're having a baby and you go out to celebrate. You know, that's emotional eating as well, but we don't think of it that way. And what we usually focus on is how emotional eating is connected with negativity. But in reality, we do it all the time. We make decisions about food that are driven by something other than nutritional need, right?
Yes, we do. And I don't know how, I mean, we know what to eat. We've seen plenty of articles on it. I have certain food allergies and so forth, and I can tell you all about it and my plan when I'm working out and when I'm at the gym. And then a couple hours after I leave, I seem to forget it all.
That's right. Yep.
Do you hear that a lot?
I hear that a lot. I mean, and aren't we inundated with what to eat, what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat, what's the latest trend to eat, you know, what can I have, what can't I have? It changes daily, it changes monthly. Absolutely, and a lot of people say, I had the best of intentions, they just go out the window. And I think one of the things that we fail to recognize, and there's a lot more research coming out now that's going to be really helpful, but is this this concept that our brains are being hijacked by certain types of food, and so that you're making food decisions on a non-conscious level anymore, really that there are physiological mechanisms that are working behind the scenes that are driving you towards certain food decisions without intentionally even thinking about it. And if you think about that, that can be really problematic for people. We're already moving at such a fast pace. If you know that your brain is making those food decisions for you, it's a little unnerving to think that, well, shoot, am I jumping into this ice cream because there's, quote unquote, something happening for me or something wrong with me, or is that something that's happening internally that I'm not even aware of? And I think this is happening more and more and more, and just to make a blanket statement out of it, these are things like junk food, highly processed foods, foods with a lot of unnecessary added dietary sugar. These cause our brains to be hijacked, and suddenly we're making food decisions without really even thinking about it. So you add that on top of the stress and emotional eating, habit, boredom, stress, and now you really have a recipe for disaster. And it also makes people feel like they're failing, when in reality you've got this physiological mechanism happening behind the scenes.
So what would you suggest instead of the word diet?
For me, it is food choices that you know, make up my everyday life, right? What are the types of foods that I want to eat to make up my everyday life, rather than what are the foods that I'm going to keep out or what are the foods I'm going to take out. It is what is my what are my food values, right? What is important to me when I'm choosing food? You know, what are the top 3 to 5 things that I'm looking for when I'm choosing food? What am I going to put in? And then I work from there, right? You know, what are my top priorities when I'm looking for food, rather than, oh, I can't have this or I can't have that or I have to take this out or I have to take that out. So it's not deprivation. It is what are my values when it comes to food.
And so food choices, what do you want instead of what you don't want? And what could help you stay energized and feeling good as opposed to numbing out, right? So it's more towards what you want instead of what you don't want.
That's right. And you know, in our programs, we and I work a lot with adolescents and young adults, it's really starting to shift that mindset of exactly what you're talking about, which is what is the impact of food choices? A lot of people will say, well, food isn't good or bad. And that's true. It's not good or bad. It's not some moral choice. But the truth is there are certain foods that when you eat them, there are consequences that make you feel like X, right? So, you know, I know that if I'm eating too much processed food or chips or crackers or things like that, I am more likely to finish that bag or eat more than I intended to, because again, my brain's being hijacked. It's getting signals that are saying you need more of this. I'm not getting satiety cues. There's not the nutrients in there that is going to have the outcome that I'm looking for. And so when we start to make food choices with our value system and saying, okay, what's important to me? Like you said, energy. I want to feel good. I don't want to feel lethargic. I want to feel like the food that I am choosing is giving me nutrients and adding value in my body. And these are the foods that I think will do that. And these are the foods that do that less so. So then I make a choice, right? What do I want to do with those foods? What do I want to do with the nutrient-dense foods? So it becomes less about good or bad or some moral choice about dieting or restriction, and more about, hey, I'm going to make an intentional choice about, you know, the type of fuel I want to put in my body, because that's important to me. It's in line with my values, right?
Well, when you come up against something that you know might not be in line with your values, like a ice cream sundae, and you know that dairy hurts your stomach and that it's, you know, it's not something you should eat late at night, et cetera, et cetera. How do you not get hooked by the food and the feeling and the emotion and the time and not feel also like you're depriving yourself? How do you really make that decision for good and not have any regret around it?
Yeah, so a couple things. There are quite a few exercises in the book that you can practice in repetition where, you know, when you're looking at changing your mindset, which is like a muscle, it's your mental muscle, and you have to work out that muscle every day in order to make it strong. And when you're changing your mindset, it's good to have exercises that you do in repetition. So one of my favorite exercises that we do when we're talking about food cravings or making a food decision that you know, like you said, you know, maybe a hot fudge sundae, that sounds good, and there's nothing wrong with that sounding good. It does taste good for a reason, right? There is, again, nothing moral about making that decision, yes or no. However, if I'm looking at weighing that choice and saying, am I going to choose to have this sundae, I would like it to be an intentional choice, a mindful choice. And so I walk people through an exercise where you ask yourself 3 quick questions. You say, do I want this? So if we're talking about the hot fudge sundae, do I want this? Yes. Will I feel shame or guilt afterwards? Well, let me think about that.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. And then again, do I want this? And then you make decisions from there. So I'll walk you through it for a second. So if you feel, if the answer to will I feel shame or guilt afterwards is yes, and then you're asking yourself a third question, do I want this? You might say yes to all 3. Do I want this? Yep. Will I feel shame? Yep. Do I want this? Yep. Okay. Great.
Do I want the shame or do I want the food?
That's right. And for some people, they will stop at some point along the way on those 3 questions. And for some people, they will say, you know what? I might feel some shame and guilt afterwards. I still want it. Okay, great. Then we do a chaining exercise, which is if I'm going to choose the hot fudge sundae, now I've made a mindful choice to choose it. I've kind of walked myself through, I know it's not in line with, you know, my plan. I know I might feel some shame or guilt afterwards. I'm still going to go forward with it. Great. You're making a mindful, intentional decision at this point. Then what do you want to do? There's a lot of things to do from point A to point B with the hot fudge sundae. Do you split it with someone? Do you take three bites and really slow down and mindfully enjoy those three bites and then throw it away? Do you, you know, how many bites you're going to take? Are you going to split it? How far do you have to go to get it? There's all kinds of things. People make so many food decisions all day long.
Mindlessly.
It is not an all or nothing thing, right? There's a lot of steps from point A to point B where you can shift or do something different than you did before, or move in the right direction. That shame and guilt is a piece that we work on a lot, though, which is, okay, you know, where does that come from, and why does there need to be shame and guilt around it? And there's a, you know, there's a lot to be work. There's a lot of work to be done around that shame and guilt. But even just recognizing that you might be making a decision that you know somewhere is not going to make you feel very good later is an intentional choice, and it's something we can work with. You can move from that if you are slowing down to mindfully make a decision.
I see. Well, that actually really, when you break it down like that, it helps a lot. That's a perfect example. Do I really want this? And maybe if I get it, can I split it with someone and then really enjoy the three or four bites you have and then be okay with that? Be done.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you're not having lack. You're still enjoying the time, especially eating out when you're with people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when it takes over, is this is going to make me, you know, it's social eating because you're involved in a conversation, but you're not necessarily involved with what you're eating. And then there's, you know, when people order things at the table, like fried appetizers and things like that, yeah, you have to have that mindset built in and a plan built in rather than just trying to resist the food.
Right.
Good point.
That's right. And I think sometimes people lose track of, and they get caught in these cognitive distortions where it becomes, it's black or white. It's all or nothing, right? I'm either happy with what I'm doing or I've blown it, and so you know, I might as well do whatever I want. And I try to slow people down and get them to realize there are thousands of decisions. There was a study done, I think it was out of Stanford, looking at how many food decisions people make a day, and it's something like 2,000 food decisions a day. And so if you think about that, it's not the one decision that's going to get you in a place where you feel like you're out of control or you're not happy with where you are, you know, physically or emotionally. It's those hundreds of decisions that you make every day, right? And so if it becomes, like you just said, someone orders, you know, fried pickles or something at the table for the restaurant, and you have a couple, and suddenly you say to yourself, oh, I said I wasn't going to eat these fried pickles. I've blown it. Well, whatever. I'm going to order whatever I want, and now I'm going to have the margaritas.
It's
and
over.
Dessert. Mm-hmm. It's over. If you're slowing down enough to say, you know what? Yeah, I did. I had those pickles. What am I going to do next, right? What's my next decision? It's always the next decision that's the most important that I talk to people about because it's not that one decision. If it were just one or two decisions over the weekend, you really would be fine. It's that one decision that has now turned into the next 300 because you think you've blown it mentally that really gets us into trouble.
That's interesting. And then you go into beating yourself up and shaming for the... Now, I understand that you work a lot with teens, as you'd mentioned. And by the way, the name of Eliza Kingsford's book is called Brain Powered Weight Loss. And these are you can look her website up at empoweredwellness.com. How do you relate to the body image issue that's going on with kids, especially in teens, specifically when they're comparing themselves so much on social media? I don't see very many people taking Instagram pictures that are really like ugly. They do their best photo shoots and filters and everything they can to look as good as they possibly can.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it doesn't help.
It doesn't. And in fact, it really does hurt. And that's actually probably the topic and the thing that I am most passionate about is working on a positive body image in youth and getting them to a place where they don't spend their lives trying to measure up and going after the thin ideal and this quote-unquote perfect body that doesn't exist. And, you know, social media has just made that so much worse for our youth because, like you say, no one's posting their real pictures of themselves on social media. They're all made up, and it's the best angle, and they've maybe taken 300 pictures to get that one great shot, or maybe it's a professional photographer, and there's lighting, and there's makeup, and there's fake eyelashes, and, I mean, it's all these things that we can't possibly live up to, but to a young brain, or to a brain who's not intentionally looking at the impact of that, it can be very detrimental, and so one of the things we do at Empowered Wellness, we do a lot of media literacy and sort of teaching me. I remember being a kid and, you know, looking at my first Victoria's Secret magazines, right? Mm-hmm. They came to the house for whatever reason.
Right.
You're looking at these underwear models who are impossibly beautiful and thin and wonderful, and there's nothing wrong with
and
that.
And airbrushed, beautifully airbrushed,
And airbrushed, mm-hmm. But it wasn't until, I don't think it was until college that I really heard that enough or heard that a lot and then started to make that connection between, is everybody airbrushed? And right? Your teen brain gets trained to say, I don't look like that. I don't recognize these people. And, and look, I'm not trying to blame or fault the media. I don't think it's any big conspiracy, but I do think it's detrimental. I think without taking a hard, intentional look at, what the impact of that might be, there really is some emotional fallout to that, and it's teaching these young kids, males as well. So we have a lot of males in our program, and they've gone through a male body image group now, for the last month, and they're really, really enjoying looking at the, what muscularity and what the typical, quote-unquote ideal male body looks like as well. They get it from their angles, too. And
right.
So it's really important to look at the impact on our teenagers' brains with
right.
social media, teaching them how to decipher what social media is serving them and what social media might be hurting them, and teaching them to make this connection between how do you feel when you look at that, the picture of that person, and what do you say to yourself? And sometimes giving them different messages to actually input, right? So I teach the girls that we have, if you're going to look at someone on Instagram, let's call it, and say, oh, she's so beautiful, I wish I could look like that, let's switch that with, she is beautiful, and so am I.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time you scroll through that and you're driven to say, oh, she looks so beautiful, she is beautiful, and so am I. And it takes this active, intentional changing of the message internally and externally to start to make that shift, because they don't even realize that the messages that are running through their head are very quickly and very automatically going, I don't live up, I'm not good enough, I don't live up, I'm not good enough, you know?
Yes, and that's, you combine all sorts of messages in that way. If you were to talk to parents about, or a parent that might have a child that whose pediatrician said you need to put your child on a diet, where would you start with that particular parent?
Yeah, that's such a difficult one. I have parents call all the time that are saying, this is so touchy because, the pediatrician says this, and I'm struggling with how to talk to my kid about this because I don't want to give them a complex and I don't want to hurt their feelings and all this stuff. The other side of my work, what's so interesting is, yes, the body image piece is my passion and something that I'm really committed to, but the other side of my work is the fact that we do have, over 70% of our country is considered overweight or obese at this point. Those are just facts. Again, there's nothing morally good or bad about that, but it does come with health complications and medical complications.
Mm-hmm.
And kids who are overweight or obese have a 200 to 400% chance of becoming overweight or obese adults. And that comes with its own host of complications as well. And so it's important to me that at a very young age, we can start to change the trajectory of that. Honestly, first and foremost, I think the, I'm going to say easiest thing to do, but oftentimes, let's call it simple, not easy, right? The simple thing to do, the simple place to start is looking at your processed food intake. You know, and trying to consume as much nutrient-dense whole foods as possible, really. For me, when I see kids make this shift from all the processed food and junk that they're eating, which, again, is hijacking their brain and causing them to eat even more processed food and junk, a lot of things shift. Kids get happier. They have more energy. They sleep better. They relate better to their peers, to their parents. They don't turn on a dime with emotions. Things are lifting, like some depressive symptoms, some ADHD symptoms. You know, once we get off the junk food, you see a lot of changes. And again, you haven't even heard me say the word weight. There's all kinds of emotional and systematic changes that happen when we get off the junk food. So
yeah.
I would say a simple, not easy, place to start is focus solely on nutrient-dense whole foods. And again, these are things like, what do I want to put in my diet, right? Not what I'm taking out. It's what are the types of food that I am putting in. Mm-hmm. Nutrient-dense whole foods, put them in. That's what you want to eat, you know, as close to 100% of the time as possible.
It's not only that, knowing what to eat. It's like we talked about earlier. It's really having that willpower to, now you're replacing the word willpower with something else. What is it?
I mean,
do you believe in it? I mean, I've heard it a lot about that. Yeah.
Willpower is a finite resource.
You
wake up in the morning with, let's call it 100 willpower. Let's call it, you know, I'm making things up. Mm-hmm. You wake up in the morning with 100 willpower. By the time you move throughout your day, you make all your decisions, you know, go to your job, you do all the things that you have to do, and you're left in the evening, you now have 20 willpower, right? You've used your cognitive and emotional energy on other things. So I don't rely on willpower to make good decisions or make decisions that are in line with your goals. Let's put it that way. Really, it is changing that mindset. It's a larger, I guess I should say, it's a larger shift in mindset, meaning the goal is to make intentional food decisions that are in line with your values or in line with your goal or in line with your plans all day long, every day. And therefore, when you're faced with, you know, the pizza at 10 o'clock at night, and literally your willpower is gone, you're tired, you're done, you're not relying on that finite resource. You're saying, I am going to make an intentional or mindful decision about this, and it may be to eat the pizza. But then even then, it is, am I going to eat 3 bites? Am I going to eat 2 pieces? Mm-hmm. Am I going to eat, you know, am I going to share it with someone? Am I going to eat 1 bite and douse it with water and throw it away? I don't know. There's all kinds of decisions to be made. So when you say I'm replacing it with something, yes, it's a small technicality. I'm replacing it with mindfulness or intentional decision making.
Okay. All right. So that's a good way of saying it, replacing it with mindfulness. And what you said earlier about really paying attention to that art of enjoying it and eating it, we tend to, especially if you eat in front of the television or if you're eating while you're on social media, the intention doesn't go towards the food. It goes towards whatever it is that's distracting you at the moment. What about the genetics factor? If your parents were overweight or your brothers, sisters overweight, does that necessarily have to be the same for you?
The answer to that is yes and no.
Okay.
We do know that genetics do play a factor. There have been adoptive studies where twins are separated, and I'll try and simplify it, but the genes of the twins' biological parents are obese or overweight, and even in an adoptive home where they were in an environment or nurture, people would call it, of thin parents, those children became overweight, and vice versa.
Okay.
In fact, the results of those studies have shown that the kids who had the most thin adoptive parents but overweight biological parents gained the most weight, and you know, you can kind of draw some conclusions there. But the point being, there is some genetic factor to this. There is a genetic predisposition to obesity and overweight, and that genetic predisposition, in my opinion, and there is some science to support this, is going to continue to get worse as we look at the effect of insulin and passing down those genes from mother to baby. So there is a genetic influence for obesity. I like to say that, you know, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. So if you already have a genetic predisposition to obesity, and then you add on to that the things that we've been talking about, then, you know, you're susceptible to that. Biology is not your destiny, necessarily, but certainly it just means that the choices you make on a daily basis, those 2,000 choices, are really important because they're going to have an impact, right? And for some people, in fact, more and more people in our country, and we are with the birth of babies that are bigger now and that are obese before the age of 6 months, those types of things, we are showing signs of sort of breeding more obesity, and we need to pay attention.
Yeah. You know,
something is going to have to happen in our food environment and our food supply in order for us to level out at a healthy weight.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big, I mean, it takes awareness. Now, you have a great workbook here, which I think is fantastic for the brain-powered weight loss. And it's all 11 steps, which are in the book, and we can go through these. But it's really nice that you have a journal, and you get the opportunity to, I love this great question. Step one, cultivate a weight loss state of mind. Good things about losing weight. And you've got, I think, five here. I'm sure people could do more. And you also mentioned the challenging things about losing weight, but you start with the good things. And I notice that sometimes I go to complaining rather than solutions, and I'm working on that one. But if you could look at why would you want to release, say, 5 pounds? What's the benefit of that? Do you feel good? Do you feel lighter? Do your clothes feel better? Do you spend less time worrying about it? You know, what are some of the good things about losing weight? And what have you seen in there? Like, what are some good answers, or not good answers, but answers that you've seen?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, the typical ones that most people go to, they'll say, my clothes fit better. You know, I feel happier. I feel better. But what's interesting, especially with some of the feedback that I hear from parents of kids who've come through the programs, are that, sure, they talk about weight and weight as a byproduct of the behaviors that the kids are engaging in, but what they say over and over again is, you know, my kid smiles brighter. They're a different person. They hold their head higher. Their shoulders are back. They're standing taller. They're more confident, and I think some of the things that people underestimate, that they will say, oh, yeah, when I lose 10 pounds, I'll be more confident. The truth is, where you're feeling that confidence is that you engaged in behaviors over and over again that you knew were good for you, right? You know, you
are in control,
were kind to your body. You were kind to your mind. You were kind. You were kind and in alignment with what your body needed, and that is what makes people feel good. They'll say, "Oh yeah, you know, I feel really confident because I lost this 20 pounds," and that's kind of the easiest thing to jump to. But it's more about I was able to accomplish this thing when I engaged in these consistent behaviors over time, and that makes me feel really good. It increases my internal locus of control, and that's. that's a powerful factor in this. So good things about losing weight, sure, your clothes fit. You know, the number on the scale, oftentimes people get off of blood pressure medications. I've had kids get off metformin. I mean, there's all kinds of medical benefits. But I think the biggest one is just that I was good to myself, and my body and I feel more in alignment than we ever did before.
Good point. And that's probably why diets don't work, because they're so focused on the lack or deprivation or sizes of the meal or the plan or even the food that they make you eat that is associated with the program, that you don't really associate it with, this is how I want to treat my temple. This is how I want to take care of my body.
Yeah.
And I have plenty of friends and people that I've interviewed in this, in the fitness world, and they basically eat what they, what is considered healthy food, and maintain a really great lean body weight because they don't want to put anything in their temple that is going to affect their energy. And that's a great way to live.
Mm-hmm. It's a great way to live, and it's also a big mindset shift. So they're not saying, oh, well, I can't have this and I can't have that and I'm deprived of this or I'm deprived of that. It's a different way of life. It's a different way of viewing it, which is, you know, that doesn't belong in my temple. I choose not to. I don't eat those things because I don't want that here, right?
Right. It doesn't feel good.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't make you feel good emotionally or physically. And I think one of the biggest lessons we teach is, you cannot hate yourself into loving yourself. You cannot fight this body. You cannot fight yourself. You cannot hate it. You cannot put it down. You cannot wrestle with it and end up in a place where you are happy, right? So it's not until people find that alignment with, okay, I'm going to talk to you. You're going to talk to me, body. Let's figure out how we're going to do this thing together, that people can kind of settle into a natural cadence of a weight that feels pretty stable, right? It's when they stop this fighting and the dieting and the restriction, because dieting and restriction comes from, you know, I hate you. Why won't you do this thing that I want you to do?
Yes.
Why won't you budge?
Beating
up. Why won't you move? Mm-hmm. Right? There's all this beating it up and you're not aligned and you're not giving me what I want. And that never works for people. And so it's really resetting that mindset to say, all right, we're in this together. I got you. You got me.
That's great.
Right? Like, let's figure out how we're going to do this thing going forward.
A lot more friendly to yourself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, step one was to cultivate a weight loss state of mind. Step two is to face your biological truth, which we talked a little bit about, genetics. And so if you do have parents that are overweight and so forth, and you said that it's more about nurture versus nature, can you tell someone what to do if they do have an overweight parents and they want to maintain a healthy weight?
Yeah, the truth is, if you are susceptible to being overweight or obese, the truth is, it's just like anything, it's just like any other chronic condition that you pay attention to on a daily basis. The decisions you make and the culmination of those decisions are going to matter. They are. So whereas we all might know those people who can go eat whatever they want and never exercise and they never gain a pound, that's not your biology. And the first step is kind of moving past that, right? Dealing with what emotions might come up for that, this isn't fair, or, you know, how come my sister can do that, or how come my husband can do that, or whatever it is, and saying, okay, the decisions I make matter. I'm going to have to be, you know, we call the folks in our program long-term weight controllers. This is a long-term focus, and you got to shift that mindset to, this is part of my life. Decisions I make matter. You asked me in the beginning, you know, was weight a problem for me? And the answer is no, but I have obesity in my family. I have obesity and overweight in my family. And if I'm not paying attention or putting the right food in my temple, then I'm susceptible to that. And I know that. And I don't spend my time being upset about that, or I don't spend my time stressing over it and saying, why me? And you know, why can my husband eat whatever he wants and not gain weight? And he can.
Don't do that.
Right? And again, that's that emotional connection. I could spend my time being upset or angry or stressed or hate my body for biologically being what it is, but it doesn't change what is. So it's better to make that mindset shift and say, it's important that I make decisions that are in line with my goals and values on a daily basis.
Well, that's cool. Okay, so that was step two about the biology, and you cover that really nicely. Step three is identify your thinking errors and food triggers. That's a big one.
Yes.
So this is a great workbook because it's like, okay, what's your current mood? And what were you thinking when you either lost control around that particular or made a decision you didn't want to make? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and so each one of those steps that you're describing, there's a whole chapter in the book on it, and in the journal there's these little exercises that will kind of say, give you a mini introduction to what that chapter would be about, and the big things in step three, identifying your thinking errors and food triggers, is cognitive distortions. So it's things like I was saying earlier, black and white thinking, it's mind reading, it is, disqualifying the positive. There's a whole host of cognitive distortions that we find ourselves getting into, and everybody does it. If you were to read through chapter three, you'd go, oh, yeah, I do that, to a couple of them. The key is to evaluate what those are and get really, get really intimate with those cognitive distortions and how often you engage in them, and then you can move from there, right? We can't move if we don't know what they are. So meeting your mood evaluator, like you mentioned, just has you stop and think, okay, if I'm in a bad mood, let me describe it. What was I thinking? What happened before I got in this mood? And start making the connection between before every feeling is a thought, every feeling. Sad, happy, elated, depressed. There are thoughts that come before every feeling. And the more you can start to look at that connection, the more opportunities we have to make some shifts.
Now, that's wonderful. Okay, so we've got the keys there. We're going through step four, which is find your wise mind through mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So this is what to do when you get into just... You want to break a pattern, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do we do that?
Yeah, so step four is actually my... If I had a favorite step, step four.
That's your favorite? No, that's good.
Just because I feel like becoming a person who lives more mindfully, especially in our day and age, technology, fast pace of life, all the things we have to distract us all the time... it is that much more important that we find mindfulness and we find our wise mind. And our wise mind is that place, that gut, that place that does not steer us wrong. So, this whole chapter is dedicated to finding our wise mind through mindfulness techniques.
I like that. And it's important, especially to get present to what you're doing.
Exactly.
Because if you... If you're eating mindlessly, you're usually not in the present. You're behind or in front of yourself. Okay, what about when you are, though, triggered by something, which it'd be an upsetting situation or something that triggers you into a negative eating pattern?
Mm-hmm.
How do you use and deal with that in order to not go to food?
Yeah, so there's a number of techniques. One of the techniques is the STOP technique, and STOP is an acronym, the STOP technique, so that you can kind of let go of the thought that is the trigger. The thought, again, the trigger would be the emotion, whether it's anxiety, anger, fear, sadness, whatever it is, but there was a thought that preceded that. So you want to, one of the techniques we can use is the STOP technique, and the S is to stop what you're doing. You have to sort of short-circuit it. You have to take that moment to intentionally stop. T is to take a deep breath or two. Taking deep breaths sounds very simple, but it actually starts to reset your nervous system, helps your mind slow down, helps your body slow down, and your brain be able to process things in a different way. observe your feelings and your thoughts, right? So you're kind of taking this meta-processing approach of, all right, what am I thinking right now? What am I feeling right now? And then you proceed with intention. And again, you're making that mindful decision to say, all right, what do I want to do next? It sounds very simple, but really it's the short circuit of we just go along throughout our day. We have these emotions. We react to these emotions. We meet that reaction with the behavior, and we just keep going. The stop technique is very quick, and it has you actually stop what you're doing and make an intentional decision. Stop, take a deep breath, observe your feelings, observe your thoughts, proceed with intention. It's very simple, but it can be, again, with repetition, it can be life-altering.
Mm. Now, this is, I love this technique, and it comes in the step six, the mental resilience technique. And it's so simple, and everyone should write this down. If you ever have a problem with eating something or being faced with eating something that's overindulging.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this. You can stop at number one, say, will I feel guilty, frustrated, or disappointed after eating this? Now, if you are answering yes to that question, then what do you say?
Yeah, then it can be, am I okay with eating it anyways? It's a simple but very important question, because you can be okay with eating it anyways if you're going to feel guilty, frustrated, or disappointed. But at least ask yourself that. Connect with your body and say, am I going to feel guilty, frustrated, or disappointed after eating this? Yeah, I think I might. Am I okay with that? Well, I don't know. Let me check in, right? A lot of people, that's enough for them to say, you know what? No, or you know what? I just want one bite or two bites, or I'm going to skip it tonight, or maybe I'll ask myself tomorrow, or maybe I'll ask myself in an hour. It's that check-in. It's that mindful, intentional check-in.
Do you find that the more you exercise those two things, that the less you fall into eating a bad eating pattern?
Is that absolutely.
Over time
even,
really work?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. I, for example, last night, my husband, daughter, and I took our first bike ride down to the ice cream shop for summer, right? It's summertime, mm-hmm. ice cream shop. You know, we're taking mm-hmm. a bike ride, family bike ride. It's very nostalgic, and there's all this emotion with it, right? We were kids, and you used to ride your bike to the ice cream shop. And he wanted a milkshake, and I asked myself this question, you know, do I want some of it? He wanted to split it. No, I'm not going to split it, but I'll have a couple bites, whatever, right? And I went through this exercise and saying, do I want some of this? First of all, I have done enough work and asked myself this question enough time that will I feel guilty, frustrated, or disappointed after eating this? The answer was no. I wasn't going to feel guilt, frustration, or disappointment. But I knew that that was because I was making a mindful decision to have a little bit of the shake. I had two or maybe three kind of, you know, bites of it. I was really satisfied. That was all I needed. Mm-hmm. I had it. It was really good. It was three bites. I have no idea how many calories or what macronutrients made it up. I don't know.
Doesn't matter.
But it was really good and satisfying, and that was that, you know?
That's cool. That's great. And so the more you practice that, the easier it becomes.
That's right.
To move through. And so these are life techniques. These are not diets, which really does help, especially when you're it sets you up for a life of the body that you want rather than struggling to get the body
right.
that you want.
Yep.
Step seven is movement. Now, have you met people in your practice that over-exercise, like they eat a lot, but then they exercise the next day thinking it's going to be better? Or have you dealt with that in your practice?
Over-exercise? Sure. Yeah. My background, you know, before I really fell in love with obesity treatment and weight management, was in eating disorders. And so I definitely saw folks who used exercise in a way that wasn't serving them, right? In a way that wasn't making them feel joy and happiness and at peace. There was a lot of over-exercising. And over-exercising really is another form of punishment and hatred and, you know, I feel guilt or shame or bad, and I'm going to punish you, body, or punish myself, individual, for the things that I feel guilty or ashamed about. For me, activity or movement or exercise should bring joy and peace and, you know, benefits of mental clarity and, you know, what do I like to do? And so I try to make that mind shift with people of, you know, what would you enjoy if you had, if you knew you had to move every day? What would you do? What sounds fun? And I think people feel like, oh well, you know, if I have a lot of weight to lose or I want to lose a lot of weight or something, the only way to do that is this thing. It's got to be this amount of cardio and it's got to be this amount of weightlifting and it's got to be this and this and it's got to be rigid. And again, even that intense holding on of your values and beliefs like that is going to make your body respond to you differently than if you were to say, hey, body, you know, what do you want to do today? Should we go for a walk? Mm-hmm. Do you want to do some yoga?
Well, sometimes I don't feel like working out, but when I get there, I feel great. Mm-hmm. And it's like the first 10 minutes and I feel like going longer. I feel strong or I feel happy. And I don't always feel like doing it, but I know the result of how I feel afterwards. So,
and don't you feel like there's a certain level of connection, perhaps, that you've made to your body to know enough if it's, you know what, today is not the day. I'm not feeling well. I'm not feeling the energy. We're going to take a break today. Or if it's a, I'm just not feeling the motivation today, but I've made this commitment to myself, and I'm going to follow through with that commitment. It's a subtle difference, but if you have that relationship with your body where you can really check in, then it'll tell you, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really important. Now, there's the, again, my guest is Eliza Kingsford. The name of the book is Brain-Powered Weight Loss. How do people get this journal, by the way, that I'm talking about?
Yeah, so the journal came out. So what I would say is go to my website, ElizaKingsford.com or EmpoweredWellness.com, and get on the contact list, and we will send you a copy of the journal, and it's free, and it is 11 pages, and you're welcome to fill it out and follow along with it, and I'm happy to send it to you.
That is so cool. Thank you for that. Step 8 is one of my favorites, and I think this is the key to everything. And it's basically set smart goals and plans, and at the end of every day, you spend 3 minutes to check in with yourself and say, what were your goals? Did you achieve them? So simple, but it's a daily accountability exercise, much like writing your food down for the at the end of every day to become accountable and aware of your food choices, which is, I think, one of the best ways to lose at least 3 to 4 pounds is doing that. You will find out where all your little hidden sneaky foods are. But this is along the lines of, you could put this at the end of your food journal for that day. What were my goals and did I achieve them? Now, what if you have a no to the answer? Nope, I blew it today. What do you do about that?
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that accountability piece, it's less, again, about diet restriction and more about, you know, accountability and what were my patterns, and you can learn a lot from writing things down. So same thing with your goals. And no, if you didn't achieve them, you what you want to look at is, which ones didn't I achieve? Could I or should I have done something differently that might have changed the outcome? For instance, if your goal was to work out, and that was the one that you didn't achieve, what you're asking yourself is there something looking back on it now that I could have or should have done differently? And if it's that you had meetings run over at work and then you had to go get the kids and then you had to make dinner, okay, maybe there wasn't something you could have done differently. But if it was something like you were talking about earlier, which was, oh, I just didn't feel like it, and so I didn't put my shoes on, I didn't go, you can write down there, again, for accountability, well, yeah, I felt tired in that moment, but I could have put my shoes on and just tried to see how I felt at the gym. And then what you're looking for is over time, right? Does that happen 3 times a week? Were you feeling like you're not motivated? Right? Is there a pattern of behavior there with the goals you're not achieving? And then you're looking at, did I overachieve any, right? If you set a goal for yourself to walk 2 miles a day and you're walking 4, you might need to look at your goals, right? Give it a little stretch goal, a little bit more, right? So it's that accountability and the meta processing of, I'm not just a follower of my life. I am an active participant in my decisions, and I'm looking back on those on a daily basis to say, how did I do to myself today, right?
Yes, that's good. So then you're understanding where, and consistency is also key here, is you can set it up for 30 days and you all of a sudden make it a habit. And again, this is so much easier than a diet.
Yeah.
Then did I eat 3 ounces of chicken today, and then I have 5 servings of vegetables, and
this is
a lot, and it work, and it's so much more effective because it's longer lasting. The ninth step is preventing a lapse by becoming a relapse. Preventing a lapse from becoming a relapse.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So it's back to those decisions that we talked about earlier about 2,000 decisions being made in a day. A lapse would be, let's call it, if you're making 2,000 decisions about food a day, and let's say you even make 100 of them that weren't in line with your plan, that's a lapse. A lapse becoming a relapse becomes, oh, man, I've blown it, so now I'm going to, I'm going to get back on my diet tomorrow, and, oh, shoot, it's Thursday, and why would I possibly start on Friday, so I'm going to go through the weekend, and now it's Monday, and you just don't feel like it because you've been off the wagon now for 4 days, and I'm just feeling lethargic, and next thing you know, it's a week and a half before you look back again and say, oh, man, I've really strayed. That is a relapse. A lapse is a decision saying, well, that wasn't in line with my plan. A relapse is that snowballing into something that's gotten away from you. So you want to try, like I said earlier, it's your next decision that matters, not the one decision, it's the next one, right? So that's the difference between lapsing and relapsing.
Got it. I think that's a great point. And you have a lot more to go through when you, that, you know, less punishing and more getting right back on track.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And less judgment, less self-judgment, getting right back on track.
That's right.
So I think I've made a couple here. The 10th one was outsmarting high-risk situations. And you'll have to just do all this. Go onto the website, which is empoweredwellness.com, and you can get this journal there and get the book as well, Brain-Powered Weight Loss, and find out how to change your thoughts and feelings and practices. And it's more about not just change your thoughts. I like these. It's very, very practical where you can go through these very practical exercises just by following this 11-step plan and going through this journal. I'm sure you've had people have success from this.
Yeah, we absolutely have. And I think the key is, like you said, it goes beyond just changing your thoughts, because I think that's not new information to people, right? They know they need to make a mindset shift. They know that it might be happening in their mind or in their brain, but they don't know how, right? They don't know how to get from point A to point B. Well, how do I do that? How do I change how I feel about myself? Or how do I change, you know, this high-risk situation or what's stressing me out? And the book really step-by-step gives you tools and exercises to come back to, and that with repetition can get from that point A to point B in that mindset shift.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you being a guest. This is very solid information that can last from everyone from adults to teenagers. It's terrific. Thank you again, Eliza. Great information.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you all for being a part of this show. Your energy is what makes these shows happen. Thank you so much. I am Lisa Garr. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.